Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Mario Ritter Jr., and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present the next part in our series on America's national parks. But first, here is Pete Musto.
They fly at speeds over 1.5 kilometers a second, sometimes faster. They move in ways that make them extra difficult to find and destroy in flight. United States President Donald Trump calls them super-duper missiles, although they are better known as hypersonic weapons. And they are at the heart of Trump administration worries about China and Russia. For years, the U.S. has searched for ways to get ultra-fast flight right. But it has done so unevenly, suspending research projects and then starting them up again. Now, China and Russia are arguably closer to perfecting the necessary technology. And the Trump administration is setting aside billions of dollars a year for hypersonic offense and defense. The U.S. Defense Department is clear about its purpose. Mark Lewis is the department's Director of Defense Research and Engineering for Modernization. In March, he told reporters, "Our goal is simply, we want to dominate future battlefields." Critics argue that hypersonic weapons would add little to the U.S. military's ability to prevent war. Some think such weapons could lead to a new destabilizing arms race. Two things make these weapons special: speed and maneuverability, the ability to make complex movements. Speed brings surprise, and maneuverability makes the weapons difficult to follow. Together, those qualities could mean trouble for missile defenses. By generally agreed definition, a hypersonic weapon is one that flies at speeds higher than Mach 5, or 5 times the speed of sound. That is about 1,234 kilometers per hour. Most U.S. missiles, such as those launched from aircraft to hit other aircraft or ground targets, travel between Mach 1 and Mach 5. Trump sometimes talks about his interest in hypersonic weapons, sometimes without using the correct term. In February, he told state governors visiting the White House, "We have the superfast missiles, tremendous number of the superfast. We call them superfast, where they're 4, 5, 6, and even 7 times faster than an ordinary missile. We need that because, again, Russia has some." And earlier this month, Trump told reporters, "We have no choice. We have to do it with the adversaries we have out there," naming China and Russia. The U.S. Defense Department is working on 2 main kinds of hypersonic weapons. One, called a hypersonic glide vehicle, is launched from a rocket. It then maneuvers to a target at high speed to avoid interception. The other is sometimes called a hypersonic cruise missile. Launched from a fighter jet or bomber, it would be powered by a supersonic combustion ramjet or scramjet. This helps the missile to fly and maneuver at lower altitudes. On March 19th, the military flight tested a hypersonic glide vehicle at its Pacific Missile Range facility in Kauai, Hawaii. Pentagon officials called the test a success. Unlike Russia, the United States says it is not developing hypersonic weapons for use with nuclear arms. As a result, a U.S. hypersonic weapon will need to be better at reaching targets. As recently as 2017, the Pentagon was spending about $800 million on hypersonic weapon programs. That nearly doubled the following year, then rose to $2.4 billion a year later, and hit $3.4 billion this year. This project is highly important to the Pentagon, but it could become limited by the budgetary pressures that are expected as a result of federal spending on coronavirus-related issues. China is pushing for major developments in hypersonic weapons. It has carried out successful tests of the DF-17, a missile designed to launch hypersonic glide vehicles. A U.S. Congressional Research Service report shows that the DF-17 missile is designed to travel between 1,600 and 2,400 kilometers and could be deployed later this year. Last December, Russia said its hypersonic missile system had become operational. Critics see hypersonic weapons as unnecessarily dangerous and a continuation of the arms race between the U.S. and former Soviet Union. A 2017 report from the RAND Corporation Research Group warned about these technologies spreading to countries other than China, Russia, and the U.S. I'm Pete Musto.
Around the world, special health workers are playing a part in efforts to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. They are serving as contact tracers. Contact tracing involves investigative and nursing skills, among others. Tracers seek information from COVID-19 patients about their contacts with other people. The goal is to create a map of every place an infected person has been and who they have met. Some countries have developed national systems. In the United States, programs are created by the states. Mackenzie Bray is a contact tracer in the state of Utah. She usually investigates sexually passed diseases. Now, she is one of 130 people at the Salt Lake County Health Department ordered to track coronavirus cases in the Salt Lake City area. The investigators, many of them nurses, each work on 30 to 40 cases at a time. They try to talk to every person who came within 1.8 meters of the infected person for 10 minutes or more. On one recent case, Bray called a retired man just confirmed to have COVID-19. She said she asked him many questions about who he had been near in the 7 days before the call. She also suggested that he go through his bank statements to help him remember which stores he might have visited. During the call, the man's wife said that family members had come to the couple's home on Mother's Day. Bray asked if the group had shared food or drinks. The answer was yes. Suddenly, the contact tracer had more people to call. Tracers try to contact every person who came within 2 meters of an infected person. They remain in touch with some of the people throughout the 14-day virus incubation period. A single telephone call can take 30 minutes or more, as tracers must ask a long list of questions. Some experts estimate that 300,000 contact tracers might be needed in the U.S. to limit the spread of the coronavirus. States like Utah say they have enough, but other states say they need hundreds or even thousands more. The contact tracers often deal with a lot of conflicting information. Language and culture barriers can add misunderstanding into the data. Sometimes people do not answer questions from tracers truthfully, by accident, or purposely. Health investigator Maria DeCaro was in contact with one infected man who suddenly stopped returning DeCaro's calls. She discovered he had been sleeping in his car because of marriage problems. DeCaro found out when she questioned the man's child. DeCaro said she needs people to cooperate with her. No one is legally required to answer questions. So, she has found that treating people with kindness works better than strong words. Bray, the Utah investigator, said people sometimes think contact tracing is black and white, but there is a lot of gray that goes into it. Anissa Archuleta and members of her family were exposed to a man infected with coronavirus at a birthday party. DeCaro called the family every day for 2 weeks. During that time, the family was tested and found not to have the coronavirus. But DeCaro learned a lot about the family. After a while, Archuleta began asking DeCaro about how she was doing, and thanked her for caring about her and her family. DeCaro said it made her feel good to hear the praise and thanks for her work. "It's nice to be appreciated," she said. I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
VOA Learning English. This is the Health and Lifestyle Report. More people around the world have been tested for the new coronavirus. and found to have COVID-19. As a result, doctors and other healthcare workers are reporting new COVID-19 symptoms. The most common symptoms are a high temperature or fever, a dry cough, and shortness of breath. However, less common symptoms are also being reported. These include a loss of smell, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain, swelling, and skin problems. The Associated Press reports that children are the latest group to be affected with new symptoms. Healthcare workers say some children who have tested positive for the coronavirus are having abdominal pain and swelling. However, they do not have the more common breathing problems that affect older adults. The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, told the AP recently that his state is now investigating about 100 cases of a COVID-related condition in children. It affects blood vessels and organs and has symptoms similar to Kawasaki disease. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the United States says Kawasaki disease usually affects children age 5 and younger. The symptoms include fever, rash, swelling of the hands and feet, irritation and redness of the whites of the eyes, swollen lymph glands in the neck, and irritation and inflammation of the mouth, lips, and throat. Health officials in New York City have reported that at least 52 children have become sick with the condition. 3 deaths have been reported. Hospitals in the state have been advised to place high importance on COVID-19 testing for children showing these symptoms. Parents are urged to call their doctor immediately if their children show symptoms, including long-lasting fever, rash, abdominal pain, and vomiting. Children in other parts of the U.S. and Europe have also been hospitalized with a similar condition. There also are reports of COVID-19 patients having skin conditions, such as rashes. In one report, doctors looked at 88 COVID-19 patients in an Italian hospital. Italy has one of the highest numbers of infected people. They found that 1 in 5 patients had some kind of skin problem. These symptoms were mostly red rashes over the area of the body between the neck and the waist. In another report, Spanish doctors reported that 375 confirmed virus patients had skin problems. These included different kinds of rashes and swollen toes. Skin doctors, or dermatologists, were expecting to see more skin problems as the virus continues to spread. A dermatologist at Massachusetts General Hospital explained to the Associated Press that viruses often affect the skin. Dr. Esther Freeman said seeing skin rashes become a symptom of COVID-19 did not surprise her. However, one probable symptom did: COVID toes. COVID toes are red, painful, and sometimes itchy, swollen areas on the toes. Doctors say the condition looks like tissue problems on the feet of people who have spent a long time outdoors in the cold. Dr. Freeman directs an international COVID-19 registry for doctors to report cases of possibly virus-linked skin symptoms. Of 500 cases reported since late March, She said about half involved red, swollen spots on the feet. It is still not clear when COVID toes might appear in coronavirus-infected patients. For some people, it is the first or even the only symptom they notice. Others see the toe problem at the same time or even a few weeks after experiencing more common and serious COVID-19 symptoms. Another dermatologist said that COVID toes are showing up in young people too. Amy Paller is a children's dermatologist at Northwestern University. She is collecting pictures of patients' toes to learn more about the possible condition. At this time, doctors do not know how the virus causes COVID toes. However, doctors at the American Academy of Dermatology gave advice on how to deal with concerns about COVID toes. The first step is a meeting, possibly by video conferencing, with a doctor. The next step is to find out if the person has other COVID-19 symptoms. If there is no other reason for urgent care, the doctor would then decide whether a patient should stay at home or get tested. However, doctors should discuss each patient's overall health and history before moving on to testing and other care. Whatever a person's symptoms might be, doctors remind us of this warning. People can carry and spread the virus without experiencing any symptoms. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Sometimes a visit to a national park means hiking rugged trails and climbing high mountains. Other times, it means crawling through caves or rafting down a wild river. But we want to take it easier. So we head south to the state of Arkansas. It is home to a national park that is perfect for resting and renewing a tired body. Visitors treat themselves to one of its natural thermal baths. Humans have been enjoying the warm waters for thousands of years. Welcome to Hot Springs National Park.
Most national parks are far from cities and industry, but Hot Springs is different. It covers more than 2,200 hectares in and around the city of Hot Springs, Arkansas. Congress approved special protection of the area in 1832. Known unofficially as America's Spa, it became a national park in 1921. The park's geothermal springs and other resources have long been used for therapeutic bathing. The average temperature of the hot springs is 61 degrees Celsius. The thermal mineral waters reportedly help ease many health problems, including arthritis and rheumatism. The springs emerge along the western edge of Hot Springs Mountain. Scientists say the hot springs are made of rainwater that fell in the Hot Springs area thousands of years ago. The rainwater slowly dripped down to the Earth's crust. When water rises back up to the surface quickly and does not have a chance to cool, Hot Springs form.
Hot Springs National Park's early bathhouses were simple structures. They were made of canvas and lumber. They were built right over some of the natural springs. Later, businessmen built more complex wooden structures. But those structures were frequently damaged by fires and from exposure to water and steam. Beginning in the early 1900s, stone, stucco, and brick structures replaced the wooden bathhouse buildings. These large and much more elaborate structures still stand today along what is known as Bathhouse Row. These bathhouses were built along the eastern bank of Hot Springs Creek. The hot water from the hillside springs flows down a system of wooden troughs and into the buildings.
Each spring was said to help cure different kinds of conditions. Some of the early names referred to their chemical properties. Others were named after the part of the body that its waters could best help. There was once a spring called Kidney, and another named Liver. 8 buildings line Bathhouse Row today. They are very large. Many of them are 3 levels, but most of them no longer offer therapeutic water treatments. Instead, they house park shops and the visitor's center. But one has remained open for more than 100 years. The Buckstaff Bathhouse has operated continuously since 1912. It is one of the best-preserved bathhouses within Hot Springs National Park. Visitors today can enjoy traditional thermal mineral baths. The baths are different temperatures and have different properties.
Another bathhouse offers a more modern spa experience. Quapaw Baths and Spa also sits along Bathhouse Row. It was renovated and reopened in 2007 on Hot Springs' 175th anniversary. When you are done with your relaxing bath, there is still more to enjoy at Hot Springs National Park. Visitors can hike along the more than 43 kilometers of trails in the park. You will find unusual rock formations and views of the surrounding rolling hills. The landscape provides evidence of the area's hot spring history. On the Tufa Terrace Trail, you will see huge deposits of tufa, created by the flowing springs over thousands of years. Tufa is a kind of rock shaped by water.
But you do not have to hike to see the sights. There are beautiful mountain roads to drive as well. However you explore Hot Springs National Park, you can't help but relax. I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.